Hello, and welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. I'm your host, Erin Bowles. I am a writer, actor, and comedian. And if you would like to support the podcast, please go to buymeacoffee.com/required reading. Our guest today is Darren Simpson. He is an educator with more than 25 years of experience teaching and working with students in Idaho, Indiana, and Massachusetts. He lives in Boston with his wife, Jennifer. They have five grown children and five perfect grandchildren. And Darren enjoys walking along the harbor, cheering for the Celtics and Red Sox, and writing contemporary middle grade fiction. He received his PhD in education from the University of Idaho. My childhood friend, Trish Franks, who was just on the show, introduced us. And I'm so glad to have you here. Hello.
Hello, I'm really grateful to be here. And you read that little bio perfectly,
Oh,
right?
thank you.
We are within.
So our book today is such a staple. I can't believe it's taken us this long to get to. Roald Dahl's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory from 1964. What's your story with this book? How did it come into your life?
So first, I love the premise of the podcast. I've listened to a bunch of the episodes. It's really fun. And just the prompt that you have of, a book pre-high school that meant something to you was a great exercise for me. So it kind of took me on a spin of, so I read several, right, in this trying to kind of pinpoint one. And I remember thinking, this was probably one of the first books I remember being read to me when I was
Oh.
in grade two or three, right? So as an elementary school kid. And that I was liked it enough that I wanted to revisit it and read it again. As someone not only born in the 1900s, but deeper into the 1900s, I had to think back on that book. And so I don't have a ton of memories of my first go around with it, but it's one of those that I think I would say is probably still 60 plus years later in the zeitgeist. Everybody has kind of had some familiarity with it. And I looked through your previous episodes and I was like, no one has a Roald Dahl. I'm, you know,
Yeah.
lent to picking this one as well.
Yeah. It has this cultural presence, like you said. I watched, the Gene Wilder film when I was young. I watched the Johnny Depp film, I think, when it came out. But I had never read it before. I don't know if I had ever read any Roald Dahl. Yeah, what a surprise. I know I loved the animated James and the Giant Peach. I loved that movie when I was younger. But yeah, he's this huge cultural figure that somehow I had only, I mean, I was a film and television kid much more than I was a book kid, and that's, I ended up in the right place. But it was so nice to finally like dig in and see, yeah, the source material, the original text.
Which is interesting you mentioned that about, because I think it's almost impossible for anyone to think about this one particularly without thinking about the Gene Wilder film. And what's interesting that I have found even my own children, some of which are now 30, that they don't really completely understand the media desert that we lived in when I was very young. And there were only a handful of these kind of like iconic films that you saw every year. Television would have these big things where, like, every year at Easter it was the Ten Commandments, and every year The Wizard of Oz played at one time. This was one of those. At around Christmas time, that Gene Wilder film would play again and again. And so that was one that, even though I was very young when I was a baby, like an infant when the film came out, it was still a film that was like super important to my childhood because it was one of the only ones you saw again and again. So, like The Wizard of Oz, like this, The Sound of Music you would watch with your mother again because you had to, right? But you wouldn't, again, I wasn't like super like, woohoo, this is The Sound of Music. But this one, you like, it's even hard to explain to like super younger people now what it was like to wait all year to revisit something that you had a good experience with and that you knew would only come back. You know what I mean? On that.
Yeah, like once a year. Yeah.
And so it's I
Yeah.
think possible to separate the book from that Gene Wilder film, that first film.
Absolutely. I've only seen it, a handful of times, but that, I mean, pure imagination and that whole sequence is it's indelible, it's part of it, and it's I think you comparing it, I mean, obviously they're very similar, but with Wizard of Oz, there is something just about the production design and the visuals that feels like that first entrance into Munchkin Land that has those sort of Technicolor landscape. Yeah.
Yeah, with big sets, larger than life, and a fantasy element. And probably, to be fair, the film does more of that than the book. The book, the book paints that picture at one level, but the film almost seems to like really run with that, that we wanted that initial into the factory to look, yeah, Wizard of Oz-esque, right? Like almost Munchkin Land-esque. Sure. That's a great comparison.
Yeah. I was so fascinated by, I felt like more than anything, this was a story really about location and about the sort of mystery and wonder of this factory where everything seems possible. Actually, in my little bits of research, when Roald Dahl was in maybe middle school, Cadbury would send test packages to their school. And this was, I think, in the 20s. There were these big, there were spies going between the chocolate factories with secrets. And there's a podcast called Acquired that's all about the creation of businesses. And they just did an episode about Mars that has a lot of like the secrets behind chocolate wars and things like that. He was fascinated by the giant machines and the secrecy and the wonderful, candiness of it
Right,
all.
and the end product is an offender. I mean, the end product is
Right.
also the thing that we all have this association with chocolate. And he actually worked, I think, for a bit in a chocolate factory.
Yeah, last week I recorded an episode about The Little Prince, and which means that 2 weeks in a row I've had World War II fighter pilot authors, which is so fascinating. At one point, Roald Dahl gets injured in a crash lands and gets a head injury, which he sort of jokingly credits as like, I was not a writer at all before then, but I got this head injury and I was suddenly a creative genius. And he's sent to DC as a sort of a British ambassador. And he said that his job was to help Churchill get along with FDR so that they could sort of stand each other.
I knew about his time in the Royal Air Force and his time in DC, but I didn't realize that he'd been in an injury and that he kind of attributed
Yeah.
that to his writing. Yeah, that's cool.
His first piece of writing was he had been asked to write like an article to be like, what is it like to be a fighter pilot? And then a year later, he writes his first children's book called The Gremlins, which is about gremlins getting into fighter pilots and into their planes and causing mischief. And I think that was going to be a Disney movie and then never got made. He writes a James Bond movie.
And I think there is a Looney Tunes where there are gremlins, because that was a common thing people have said in the mid 20th century that, oh, this isn't working. It must be a gremlin. I think it's a Looney Tunes, like a short before the film of gremlins that got into an airplane. But I had also
Wow.
read that he was originally had something in the works with that with Disney, but it never came about. One of the things I like about Roald Dahl in general, and I think it does come from this period of time that he lived, right? Both as an impressionable young person during the Depression and then came into his adulthood during World War II. And it's something that I think is missing a little bit today in a lot of our early childhood reading, especially middle grade reading. He's not afraid of peril and not some kind of tertiary, oh, you think there's something scary around the corner. No, honest to goodness peril. And not to, we can focus on this book, but if you look at his children litter in general, the giants eat the kids, the witches, the kids are in real peril, and there's something I think of extraordinary value at that as a young reader
Yeah.
to say, oh, this is scary, and something really scary could happen. And I think that lack of a safe place at one level has real value, right? And I think it's one of the reasons kids are still drawn to, and as an adult, I am too, because I feel like I'm not being patronized, right? Even though it's a fantasy
Right.
thing and it's a made-up world, I feel like he's like, yeah, peril is real, danger is real, and your actions have real consequences, right?
Right. I like that actions have consequences because I think that's such a lesson of growing up. But yeah, there's, I mean, certainly every character in this book, all of the other children certainly have, consequences for their actions, even though everyone more or less turns out okay in the end. Stretched and purple,
Right.
but
I certainly wouldn't have realized this as a kid. As a kid, I was probably just caught up in this idea of the peril and seeing myself as Charlie Bucket and the magic of it all. But as an adult reading it again, he's so clearly moralizing that this is the parents' fault. And like, I'm surprised how early in it, even in it, I was just like, he is showing us that these kids are the result of their indulgent parents. I think 60 years later, it's probably maybe even as profound or more profound than it was even then. All is so clear that every parent is the one driving the kid's poor behavior. He just goes to like these lengths to draw out kids are a product of their parents who, and even the little songs, right, by the workers literally will say, you didn't do your job as the parent, or like, you this way because of you. And I just thought, and I didn't, I certainly, when I was a kid, didn't realize that strong moralization. But as an adult, I was just like, wow, he really had something to say about indulging kids. And he said it pretty dramatically, right?
I love that you use the word indulgence because I mean this is a book about candy, about indulging, and certainly all of the kids are like that. But I think the thing that I was so struck by, especially in the early chapters before he gets the golden ticket, about how much it's about poverty. I mean,
Right.
I read that initially Roald Dahl wrote Charlie Bucket as a little black boy, and then the editors said, that's not going to be relatable, so we're going to make him white. I think one of the other, I mean, this Roald Dahl is in 2023, there was a lot of discussion about censorship, but something I think either in the editing or in the first publication, the Oompa Loompas were explicitly written as African pygmies. And then I think after the first edition came out, someone said, like, that's very offensive for these reasons. And Roald Dahl said, you know what, you're right. Let's make those changes. And I mean, a lot of people don't admit to being wrong like that, which I respect.
Yeah, for sure. I did not know that about Charlie Bucket being a black man. But the poverty really stuck out to me this time reading it again. And again, this idea that kids are in real peril. Charlie Bucket wasn't like sad and poor and lived with his grandparents. Right before he finds his golden ticket, he's describing Charlie Bucket like his system shutting down from a lot of food, from a lot of food. You know, that like he's walking slowly, the wind's going through him, he can see his own ribs. I mean, it is, he wants to really make the pathos of Charlie Bucket more than just, oh, these kids have dads who will buy him 100,000 chocolate bars. It wasn't that. I mean, it was like, this kid's gonna die of poverty. And he finds that coin, right? And he describes it almost. It almost took some of the fun, and I think he intended this to do, almost took some of the fun out of eating a chocolate bar. This thing that was this one year thing for Charlie now becomes like, well, I may die, and I found this, I can't remember what the denomination was, this small coin, I buy a couple chocolate bars. I might as well eat a couple of them before I go home to perish. But it is extreme.
Yeah, and that moment he buys a chocolate bar and he eats it, and then he decides to buy one more. And there's this huge moment there of like, what's the harm in one more? Like you said, it's about to go for it. And I think there's in the Bucket family, there's a lot of selflessness. There's a lot of sacrifice, which I think is a hallmark of poverty. But it's so interesting to me that the thing that gets him that golden ticket is that one moment of just one more. What's the harm in one more?
Yeah, and that he wasn't bringing home, that he wasn't. I that's so interesting that you picked up on that, because I did too. And there, and I even went back and read that section again to say, was there a moment, did he have anguish or guilt over it? And there doesn't seem to be, because it almost felt like that's what I was being, because he's used to one chocolate bar a year, and now he's had a second, and this third one, almost to this overarching narrative of indulgence, which you can't really place on Charlie because of his abject poverty. And that wrestle doesn't seem to be there with him. But I thought that's so interesting you picked it up, because I thought the same thing, that it was the one more that becomes the.
Because there's all of this discussion about parenting, I think I had a little bit of frustration with like, we're saying really great things about parenting. Why are we saying them in a children's book to children? But just saying that aloud makes me think of, you said that your first introduction to this was being read the story. So that is shared with parents. I mean, that's just occurring to me now. Yeah.
So now you've breached into one of my overall frustrations with children's literature, right? Is that it is literature, it's great literature, and some of it is really written specifically to appeal to kids where they're at the moment, right? And no critique.
Right.
Like Diary of a Wimpy Kid, you know what I mean? This is really, you're capturing this moment. But a lot of it, I think the authors just use the protagonist of that age to show coming of age that is emotionally resonant with all of us. And I one of my frustrations I have in the larger literary community is sometimes their dismissal of children's literature as almost like, right, the Trix rabbit. Oh, silly, silly adult. Kids' books are for kids. And I'm like, there's a lot in children's literature for us. I've seen the all right dismissal of things like Charlotte's Web and Frank
Right.
Roald Dahl, and I'm like, no, these are a good read as an adult. And I think any book that resonated, and which is why I love the premise of the podcast, any book that resonated with you in that coming of age period of time is worth a revisit again. Even for you to remember your childhood, because there's probably themes and things in there that are still going to resonate with you, but now with this whole new lived experience,
Exactly.
right?
Yeah.
Because it definitely is about parenting. There's no way you could leave this book and say it's
Yeah.
not a cautionary tale to parents, right?
Right. I assume this is in, the movies and the adaptations I'm more familiar with, but I think the thing that at the end, Wonka gives the factory to Charlie. Like every kid is sent home, with a lifetime supply of candy, which is fantastic for a starving family like the Bucketts. But I mean, Wonka says, it was a secret test to see
Right.
which kid would deserve
And
it.
then he
Yeah.
curated it to be a kid, which I had to go back and read. Because at first I was like, why is this for kids? When everybody would want the ticket. He seems to have curated this to be children.
Certainly. He says, like, I need a kid who
Right.
can listen to me, who can see the value in the way I'm doing it. And I don't know if this can be made about all children or is, specific to an individual, but that a child is an adult will come in and say, I know best. And a child will come in and say, let me listen and let me learn.
Right, which is not the way it works,
Right.
right? We want to explore and understand, which is another reason he's so brilliant in this, right? Is because we're able to see, of course, it's a cautionary tale of how the parents are treating them, but in the end, it's this, for lack of a better word, it's the virtue of Charlie that saves the day, right? Where he's just
Right.
his goodness. Right, is what and will it, Wonka is like, this is what I wanted, right? I was hoping to find,
Right.
I knew it would be you, he said, Charlie, right? Like, I knew it would be you. Every kid kind of wants to be seen too.
Absolutely. Yeah, Charlie, I was surprised for a book about parenting how little Mr. and Mrs. Bucket are present.
Yeah, they play almost no role other than their sacrifice, right? I mean, grandpa is in it for sure, plays a larger role, but their want has seemed to produce. I mean, obviously that's one of the key, it's not hidden, right? Is that their want made them nicer people.
Exactly. The want made them kinder. We can put a lot of sort of therapy speak words on it, but Charlie is forced to grow up early and he understands that things have consequences, that they have weight, that he has individual responsibility. And maybe that's the thing that he understands that we have to be responsible to each other. And that's sort of maybe what pulls Wonka to him is that this is a person who can be accountable. Yeah.
And it's so interesting because you have these six really five or six other really great kid characters. And again, I mean, we're talking about this is quite a period of time. It's 60 years now since he wrote it. And yet you can just kind of see these caricatures of a lot of how media defines children still. 60 years later, right? And some stuff is not as sensitive as it would be in 2024 with like a gust of glue and whatnot. But the point wasn't that we're body shaming this kid. The point is he's never told no. And I think you still see in education literature, in parental literature, this wrestle with what's the boundary with the kid and when have I, and he's identifying those in these kind of categories. I mean, Mike TV. If you want to just start a fight in a teacher's lounge, talk about screen time, right? Or
Right.
he's talking about it 60 years ago. I thought that was really interesting, just the way the kids all had their little niche of what they were kind of indulged in, right?
Right. What was fascinating about Mike TV, like you said, that I think has been erased from all of the film adaptations, he's toting guns. He is covered in guns. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, he had something to say even about violence in media 60 years ago. And now you have a lot of people who just kind of wax nostalgic of, oh, the good old days before media was harmful. And we know that everyone's always had these worries and concerns.
Yeah, I definitely have a knee-jerk reaction just as someone working in TV about like TV has good things, TV is good, and that's definitely like that's a personal thing. That's definitely my issue. But I would love to talk about just sort of the character of Willy Wonka. I think is you know a pillar of literature and certainly in children's literature. How do you think you interpreted that character when you were young, when you were first visiting the novel?
Yeah, so again, like it's hard to separate
Right.
it completely from the Gene Wilder film. I always kind of like that idea of him being, and the book really portrays it well too, that he's mad genius, heavy on the mad. Even a little bit to that whole premise I like of Roald Dahl, you're not always sure you trust him. Like, because he's like, well, what will happen? Well, is the furnace on or not on? I don't know. She might get burned up today. He doesn't seem
Yeah.
overly animated about the things that would animate everybody else. Well, I think she'll not be a blueberry forever. Because what matters the most to him is this genius thing that's going on with the inventions. And
Right.
so I think we shouldn't over develop him to where he's some kind of like gravitas Gandalf genius.
Right.
I don't think that was Roald Dahl's intent. I think we're supposed to feel like we're a little bit teetering on his mad genius of, he's clearly benevolent, right? He likes Charlie. He wanted it to go to someone who he thought had a good moral standing, but he's also not afraid to send a kid out the top,
Yeah.
too, right? And so,
Yeah.
but I didn't love that. I think it was 2005. That was the one
Right.
I didn't love that depiction because he was only kind of weird, like only quirky.
Yeah.
There never seemed to be any of that for a reason. It just was quirky,
Yes. I
and
love
so
that.
yeah. So I remember really falling in love with Charlie Bucket in that adaptation, but kind of like, Wonka. Whereas Gene,
Yeah.
even in that opening scene where he does that tumble, you're like, what? What? You're just never quite sure you trusted him.
Definitely. I mean, I don't know if you can really find a better actor for that role than Gene Wilder. And I think something he does so wonderfully there is that sinisterness. Like that is that hallmark of Roald Dahl, that he's always a little frightening. And I think with Johnny Depp, it's like, no, this is just unsettling. I'm just uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect way of saying it. It goes back to that idea again of that kids are in peril, right? And not to stray too much from this particular piece, but Matilda is in peril. James and the Giant Peach is in peril. The kid with the BFG, right? There's a danger there. It's pretty clear reading it again as an adult that we're just going to tick off these kids, right? One by one, they're going to
Right.
have met their end. And yet, all through it, he's kind of maybe ambivalent is too strong. But he certainly isn't alarmed. And he is not alarmed. He may be somewhere
Right.
between passe and almost giddy that it's happening to him, but he certainly isn't ever worried too much.
Yeah, there's a line, I think, right at the end where all of the other kids are exiting the factory, and he's like, oh, they left him on the taffy machine for a little bit too long. That's okay. And I think actually Roald Dahl was extremely tall, and that was sort of something that stuck with him throughout his life. And I think the BFG might be loosely based on how very tall he was. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. That's a great insight. I didn't know.
He's got all these really fun ideas for different candies and such, but there was one that struck me for very obvious reasons, but that there is a candy that is a full meal. And I don't think they explicitly say it, but like about the fullness of it, the nutritional value. But what a revelation for a kid like Charlie to have, this little like magic pill almost that would save his whole family.
Yeah, or at least give them some kind of satiation, right? That they would feel like they were eating something. He definitely was wanting us all to explore all the possibilities with all of the different inventions. And that's, again, I think to this, what creates it, why one of the reasons it lives on, because I don't feel like anybody, even it's very short, it's like 20,000 words or something,
Very.
but it opens enough magical doors that I think anyone feels like they could explore it. Because just even in that brief narrative, there's so many of these like this everything gum that's the whole meal that it just kind of unlocks our imagination to allow us to that there are no limits to what could be created.
Absolutely. I think that's definitely a hallmark of successful media is that it has all the potentials for spin-offs and sequels and every little idea and invention in here you want to create a whole story behind and explore and what made Wonka think of that on this day. And I wish we knew a little bit more about Wonka. I don't need his backstory, but a few more little details.
And I remember I read the second one, Charlie and the Glass Elevator. I didn't read it this time for this, but I remember reading it as a kid, and I don't remember what happens. And I was surprised when in reading this time, reading about him, that he had a third one in mind, but just never got to it. That he had wanted. So I'm assuming we would have got more Willy Wonka in those. I've forgotten whether we get more of it in the Charlie and the Glass Elevator.
It's interesting to think, I mean, we're both writers, that you always put pieces of yourself into the final product, into every little character. And I think it's natural to put yourself in the shoes of the protagonist, especially in a children's novel. But I really think Dahl sees himself as a Wonka. I know that for a book about poverty, he was not poor. I think his father died when he was 4 or 5 and got like 8 million pounds or something in inheritance.
It's a really great insight. He must have seen himself more in the lens of Wonka. The other thing that's interesting to me is that Wonka doesn't do the moralizing, right? It's left to the Oompa Loompas and it's left to us as the reader to just see it demonstrably before us. There's some scenes like Grandma Josephine says in one of the, oh, when Charlie doesn't get his birthday ticket, she says, yeah, it'll probably happen to some of those rotten kids. Is kind of how she says it. So the moralizing is done by everybody but Wonka. And I think so often we're tempted to take that central character and then he gives us the fable punchline, right? The kind of moral punchline. We don't get that from Wonka. It's from everyone else around. And it's, I think, just clear to us as we've journeyed through it. And Charlie doesn't do it. Charlie doesn't go, I'm glad I'm a good little boy. You know what I mean? He just sees the shenanigans that ensue. And gets the lesson that we all do. And I think that's interesting that Roald Dahl didn't tie him up. You know what I mean? No, I don't mean tie him up like constrain him, but he didn't like put a nice bow on Willy Wonka. And then Willy Wonka says, and see, Charlie, if you're a knucklehead, you don't get things. You know, he doesn't have to do that because even then, the motivation seems to be for Wonka, the factory, right? You're the guy to move my legacy forward, right? As opposed to don't be those kids. It's about the affirmative approach at what he wants going forward, as opposed to those distraction things that didn't get him to his end.
Wonka is much more focused on himself, maybe not selfish, but he's the kids misbehaving, that's a parent's job, and sort of like, well, and that's his sort of flippant attitude towards these kids, getting sucked into this or that. Like, that's not my job. I'm not concerned with children being rude or not, because that rudeness will meet its own end.
Yeah, in fact, the most animated he gets, as I went back and looked, is at Augusta because he didn't want to mess up the chocolate. Like the others, he's like, don't do that. It won't be good for you. You know what I mean? Whatever. But Augusta, he's like, hey, you'll mess up my. It has to be mixed by waterfall. That's the only way, you dope. And so don't mess up my chocolate, I thought was super interesting. So I've got a question for you, if you don't mind. Having never read a Roald Dahl, but having had experience with media portrayals of it, what surprised you about it? Like what did you read it that you were like, oh, I didn't know it would be X?
Yeah, I think everything about the parents and the children. I think when I had experienced this media as a kid, I was just sort of like, these kids are annoying. And that was sort of it. So I think it's so intelligent and so masterful, and also feels so obvious that children's media should also speak to adults. You know, that feels like it shouldn't be a revelation, but it is. And I think that's something that kind of surprised me and maybe frustrated me a little bit, is that I felt like for the middle third of it, Charlie, to me, really kind of dropped out. And he sort of seemed to be defined by the antithesis. He's not defined necessarily by his actions, but by his inactions and the actions of those around him. Yeah.
Super interesting because I want to make sure I'm following your thread. I would say you would say the first part of the book, we're focused on Charlie's poverty. And then when he gets the ticket, we kind of l lose a little bit of Charlie's first person narrative when we're touring the factory because we're
Right.
showing the knuckleheadery of these other kids, which I think again, in our world, we always have gatekeepers with children's literature, right? There's this a school librarian, a public librarian, a parent, right? Kids don't have access to a lot of media literature on their own, right? They have more access to what's on television in some level than they do to their own literature, if that makes sense, right? Because sure,
Yeah.
they've got a public library, but only what the librarian put in there, right? Because they don't have the access to acquire the media themselves. One of the things that's unfortunate maybe about that is we really are careful that the kids aren't put in any kind of dangerous circumstance or whatever. Like I can even hear agents and things that have talked to me about my own work. They'll be like, well, the kid's not driving the story here. And at one point I want to say, well, why should they? Like, do
Right.
you know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, of course, you don't want to lose a narrative thread or whatever, but at one point, no, adults are part of this kid's life. And to have someone else take the driver's seat for a minute is often how kids' lives really go. This is,
You're
you know, you
absolutely
really
right.
live it everywhere. You're constantly frustrated by the adult gatekeepers in your life. And so I think it's completely appropriate for some, especially middle grade reads, to have that tension in the interaction with the adults. Do you know what I mean? Where adults
Yeah, I think that's an excellent
can make
point.
comments.
Yeah. And I think that's the children's media that sticks with us and impacts us is the things that acknowledge those things. I think that invite the imagination to introduce control over whatever it may be. But
Yeah,
yeah,
like.
there's so much about lacking control and lacking that ability, not decision-making ability, but the autonomy to have your decisions matter.
And a lot of times it's just portrayed as a pouty kid, right? As opposed to some cooperative situation with the adult. And really, in short, what I'm saying is I could hear an editor today saying, no, we've left Charlie behind. Rewrite these chapters that are in the factory and include more Charlie. I'm not sure that would be the book that it is today if you know, we had had our hands on it the way they do now. I had one other question for you about reading about. Did it make you want to read more of his, or were you like, this is one and done.
I think the one I'm interested in is The Witches, because I think I maybe only watched that movie once. And I mean, Angelica Houston is phenomenal, but that
That's
scene where
terrifying.
they Oh, terrifying! To this day,
Terrifying.
that's why I avoided rewatching it. So I might, yeah, that's I think the thing that I am drawn to right now of what's the rest of that story all around that. I do want to revisit that scene because, you know, as a actor, as a filmmaker, I want to pick apart like what are those things that on the story level and then on the filmmaking level that make that scene resonate so much.
Yeah, I think then you would appreciate the same. Like, so I had not read Charlie again for a long time, but I think maybe 4 or 5 years ago, when I was more serious about my own middle grade reading, I went back and read a bunch of Roald Dahl. And then I was reading Harry Potter again, and I was struck by how much the first pre-Hogwarts in the Sorcerer's Stone
Oh,
could have been a Roald Dahl book. Kid in the
you're right.
cupboard, I mean, over the top. You know what I mean? Lives in the cupboard. They're mean to him. And then he realizes at that outing when the glass goes away, there's something about me. I mean, I was reading it, having just kind of freshly read a bunch of the Roald Dahl, like Matilda and some of the others. I was just like, oh my gosh, I can't imagine that Rowling didn't have some of that influence in her head when she wrote, because you don't get it as much in the others. But that first one, it felt like I could have reading any of these Roald Dahl books, that few chapters of Sorcerer's Stone, which I had never seen before. Seen that before. You know, I had read it a bunch with my kids and read it myself a couple times. But this last time, after I'd read some Roald Dahl again, I was just like, oh my gosh, building on this legacy. And Harry Potter's real peril.
Exactly. Talking about gatekeeping, talking about, what our children should and shouldn't access. There are definitely kids who are dealing with poverty, hunger, child abuse. And so I think we want often media and literature to be escapist, but I think the media that works the best is the things that say, like, your life is real. And I think also the thing with you're talking about Harry, and there's this thing that's different in me. And I think you mentioned this earlier with Charlie. You want so badly as a kid for someone to single you out and say you are special. And that's first with the tickets, and then with Wonka saying you are the one I choose because of your virtues.
Yeah, of course, everybody wants that. I mean, and one of the reasons we engage in literature of any kind is to have empathy. I had a friend recently who said to me, it was this shocking thing. He's this really close friend. He said, well, I don't read any fiction. And I said, what? He said, yeah, I read a lot. I only read nonfiction because I want to spend my time on learning things, as if fiction was the antithesis of learning. And it didn't really offer a critique. He could tell I was kind of flabbergasted.
Stunned.
He then sent me an article a couple of weeks later about one of the main reasons we read fiction is to engender empathy.
Exactly.
And not only do we want a kid to see themselves portrayed, right? And I'm very grateful for the change in children's literature that is including more voices and more perspectives on what real kids live through. But we also want kids who are not living in that to see, oh, this is what this looks like. This is what it would be like to be a kid who's just coming from India to the United States, or et cetera, et cetera. Fictional narratives do that for us. Fictional narratives give us a window into somebody else's experience that allows us to have some understanding or empathy that we might not have in some other way. Even when they're fantastical, like Charlie.
But that you can, there's going to be kids who are Augustus Gloops and who are Violet Beauregards and Mike TVs who can come and read this and say, and not necessarily say, like, oh, I'm a bad kid, but to say, like, oh, there are other ways of life, even though they
Right.
might. But that there are other experiences, and that though reading, like you're talking about engendering empathy, that reading about those experiences, you can say, like, oh, actually, I have a lot. I have a lot more than I realized. And to create that, gratitude and appreciation.
Yeah, for things that may not be your lived experience, right? Yeah, having never lived in a cupboard.
Never. We had a big staircase, and I would crawl underneath it as a kid for my alone time. It's obviously very
Right.
different.
Other than we both, you live in LA and I live in Boston. So I imagine we both live in more covered area than we thought we
Yes,
would have, right? And
certainly.
what my mortgage is for now a covered-like space.
Definitely. Oh my God. I think something that surprised me is the infrastructure of the factory, that it just expands like under probably all of London. It's huge, the system.
And you could just suspend reality with it, right?
There's chocolate tunnels running right beside the tubes. Absolutely. So having revisited it as an adult, what do you think your perspective has changed the most on? What were some of those biggest surprises in this reread?
How much it was a cautionary tale, how it like what you said, it's written for adult. I mean, of course it's written, from a child's perspective, but it's written to say to adults, don't ruin kids. Because there's just no way you can read it and not realize his point was adults ruin kids. And when you indulge these kids, you're ruining them. And there's no way as a second, third grade kid, but I mean, I knew the kids were naughty. I knew you didn't want to chew gum all the time, or you didn't want to be a spoiled brat like Veruca Salt. I got that. I wasn't dense, right? But I didn't realize how overtly he was saying it to adults was sure one of my takeaways now reading it again. And I was surprised again. I was surprised this time how poor Charlie was, that he was, he's not being poor, but I remember him like not being able to walk days away from maybe perishing. I thought, wow. Those are some of my initial hot takes, right? As they now 50-year-old, 50 plus reading it.
I think that was something also that really surprised me is I think we sometimes see poor little orphan characters, but we don't see the poverty and that like you said those passages in the first third where he is thinking, well, if I walk slower to school, I'll save my energy and then I won't be as hungry. Horrifying.
Right. And it's in this happy-go-lucky chocolate romp, right? And so, he was including it in this otherwise happy, upbeat story. I wish I saw myself as Willy Wonka. I don't consider myself that artistic or wonderful at all. When I was little, I would have put myself as Charlie Bucket. And I think
Certainly, yeah.
as an adult, I probably put myself in someone who has spent a lifetime trying not to raise one of the other five kids. Just hoping that my kid isn't Mike TV.
Although I will have to say the name Veruca Salt is one of my favorite names of anything ever. That's a phenomenal character name.
Course. It doesn't get much better than that.
Yeah, I hope that when I am 94, I am saying yippee as much as Grandpa Joe is. That's a
Good
great
luck.
guy.
Absolutely. I don't have any published, but I write picture books. And that's one of the things. I was just at a conference where they were talking about, even in picture books, right, which are designed for pre-readers, there's value in the kids seeing the main character in real danger, and that goes against some. They're afraid the parents won't like it, but they're like, no, there's psychological value of the kids that seeing in the depiction of a kid in trouble. So I was like, oh, I was appreciative of that.
Well, I guess to the final question, would you consider this required reading?
I think Roald Dahl is for sure. And I think this is as good as any of what he's written. I mean, not who am I to, you right? He's only sold 300 million copies, so he got something right. But I definitely think if you've not read Roald Dahl, which I am so glad you hadn't, and that now, I mean, not glad you hadn't, but so glad I could introduce you to it. But I definitely think I think Roald Dahl is required reading. I think it will help you understand other things that you've probably already read.
Definitely. It is such a huge cultural touchstone, absolutely, that has without a doubt shaped how we look at children's literature and how we look at children and our relationships to children. Absolutely.
For sure.
Great. Well, this has been amazing. Thank you so much. Is there anything you would like to plug as we round out? I mean, of course, check out Ivy's Big Debate. Anything else?
Yeah, I will make one plug. I think all of us should be broader in our reading. And I'm specifically, and you're doing a great work with this podcast. If you read something when you were young, it's worth revisiting. And it's worth, especially middle grade fiction. We just shouldn't relegate it to them's are for kids. There's just some, especially contemporary middle grade, right? Like if you're not into fantasy, if that's not your deal, that's fine. But there's just something about it. I think all of us are always discovering and rediscovering who we are, what our core values are, how that looks in life. And there's something about going back to a 10, 11, 12-year-old who's discovering it for the first time that I think resonates with us at any stage of adulthood. So I would make a plug for more reading, more contemporary middle grade, right? Which is struggling.
Fantastic.
The genre is in trouble. I mean, as far as sales, and I think that we should all read more contemporary middle grade. How about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't know that, and it's interesting to I think something that this podcast has really made me value is the transition. But yeah, going from picture books, elementary books to we covered the book Uglies a while ago, which I not a great book, not a fan, but not everyone is ready to jump straight into the Hunger Games. And so it's important to have a bridge to get there, certainly.
Okay, I shouldn't. We took a friend who had not read it, who we had all read it. We were like in this kind of family book group thing. He had no idea the premise. We took him to the first film. When they came into the cornucopia, he looked at me and he said, What's it gonna happen? Like you thought somehow it would end, that there would, and then he kind of left the theater and he was like, "You all are bad people." He just kept and we had all had collectively were excited about this piece of art that he was like, "I have no idea where you're coming from." Anyway.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, that's all I have.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for letting
Of
me, and thanks
course.
for giving me an opportunity to explore things that meant something to me back in the day. That's a great exercise.
I'm so happy. Well, I'm going to end the recording. Thank you so much to Darren. Next week, we are doing The Host by Stephenie Meyer of Twilight. You know who Stephenie Meyer is. If you would like to support the podcast, please go to buymeacoffee.com/required reading. You can find me everywhere at Erin R. Bowles. What else is there? I think that's it. I am watching The Piano Lesson on Netflix today. Very good. But I haven't finished. All right, see you then.